Today, a psalm gets redecorated for the home folk.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
This is one of those psalms, obviously, this is a scripture show. This is one of those psalms that everyone knows, at least the opening line. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Everyone has heard that quotation or used it or is familiar with it, and it actually shows up in two psalms that are practically identical. That's true in the sense of how we read them. They are practically identical. Same length, same content, just seems the same. But the minor differences that do show up turn out to be very important between these two psalms. And so Psalm 53, the psalm that we're covering today, is very much like the 14th psalm, Psalm 14. And the differences start to show up immediately. And I want to take you through them from the beginning so that you hear from the beginning what automatically attracts the attention of someone studying the psalm. So the superscript in Psalm 14 is different than the superscript in Psalm 53. In Psalm 14, the first psalm that says this, the superscript says, to the choir master of David. That's it. And so it's a psalm that's written by David, and we're supposed to use it in corporate worship together somehow. Corporate worship together, yes, that's a redundancy. I'm not the psalmist. Anyway, the point is, it's very basic, to the choir master of David. In Psalm 53, the superscript says this, and I'll read it all in just a moment, but the superscript says this, to the choir master, according to Mahalath, a maskil of David. And that might seem like a minor change, but if you've been going with me through so many of these psalms, or if you're just reading through the Psalms one at a time and paying attention to what they say, you'll know that by now we're in the second book of the Psalms, and when we started in Psalm 42 in the second book of the Psalms, we noticed a distinct difference in these more artistic, more metaphorical, more poetically, I mean, that sounds like, it's an overemphasis or a redundancy, but it really isn't, these more poetic Psalms that are written in a style that says someone has taken the time, not just organically like David with his beautiful and brilliant creativity in the woods writing directly to God, not just that, but someone with the advantages of additional education and time and generations perhaps to take the Psalms and convert them and craft them a little bit into something even more artistic. That's the point. And those psalms appear to be referred to as maskils very often, using this term, maskil. And then sometimes those psalms are assigned to a particular rhythm or a particular tune or whatever it was that guided them in the singing of it, so that it could automatically be infused with some particular mood or mode that it was going to be used in. And so to take a psalm that's so familiar, Psalm 14 was obviously familiar, and in Psalm, by the time it's Psalm 53 in this second book of the Psalms, it's just being repeated. So somebody thinks it's a really important psalm and has put it in again for us and given specific instructions. Believe me, these are not the only differences. These are just the first little differences that stand out and say, now I want to take that psalm, you all know, Psalm 14, and we're going to sing it to this tune. And I've added a little detail that I think you'll appreciate when we get to the end. That's sort of what this superscript says. And as we're reading it, we'll see exactly that. We will notice that it changes just enough to say there's something really important going on here. So the 14th psalm comes at us as simply to the choir master from David. And then let me read, I want to do this from Psalm 14 to begin with so that you can just hear the differences from the start. So if we do it from Psalm 14, the reading goes like this. The fool says in his heart, I'm reading from the ESV, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. Everything I'm saying here is identical to what Psalm 53 says, and wherever there's a change, I will point it out, okay? So all of verse 1 is identical. Then verse 2 says, the Lord, that's Yahweh, the Lord, well, that's different. Because when we get to Psalm 53, it's going to say God, the generic term for God. And it does that over and over. It's not an accidental change. Every single time in the second one, in Psalm 53, it's going to say God instead of Yahweh. So here in verse 2, it says, Yahweh looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. All those words are identical, including the last word when it says God, because it's seeking if there are any who understand and who are seeking after God. Just generically, anyone in the world, is anybody looking up and saying, is there a God up there, right? Verse 3. Gone. Went a little expository there anyway. Verse 3. They have all turned aside. All this is identical. They have all turned aside. Together, they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. Have they no knowledge? This is verse 4, identical, until the last word. Have they no knowledge, all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon, and then here in verse 4, in chapter 14, it is Yahweh, and do not call upon Yahweh? In the 53rd Psalm, the one that we're looking at today, that's going to be the word God again replaced. Then in verse 5, this is changed a lot, but the opening line is the same. There they are in great terror. Now in Psalm 53, it's going to go on to say, where there is no terror. But in Psalm 14, it's just there they are in great terror. For, and then it says this in the 14th Psalm, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You would shame the plans of the poor. So now we go on to verse 6, and I'll give you the differences in Psalm 53 when we get there. But in verse 6, this is all different, completely different than what the 53rd Psalm says, because it's addressing a different group of people. I'll explain in a moment. So in Psalm 14, in verse 6, which is actually just the last half of verse 5 in Psalm 53, it says, you would shame the plans of the poor, but Yahweh is his refuge. And then in verse 7, which is verse 6 in Psalm 53, but in Psalm 14, verse 7, it says, oh, and this is identical except for the Lord, Yahweh, being replaced, replacing God. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion when Yahweh restores the fortunes of his people. Let Jacob rejoice, let Israel be glad. And let me be explicit. The biggest change that takes place, obviously, between God and Yahweh, and I'll explain that in what it says, but the biggest changes that take place are evident in the difference between Psalm 14, verse 6, and Psalm 53, and the last half of verse 5, which is the same as verse 6 in the other one. They're just numbered differently, but that comes later. I mean, people do that after the fact. That's not in the original authors, right? So the numbers, that is, are not in the original. So what's going on in chapter 14 is the psalmist, David, teaching the enemies, whoever the enemies are out there, who Yahweh is. So here's my Lord, and this is what he does to protect us. And so he points his finger at the enemies and says, you would shame the plans of the poor. This is why he's saying to them, you bad people, you enemies, you would shame the plans of the poor. But Yahweh, our God, Yahweh, the specific God of our covenant, he is the refuge to the poor. And so he's teaching the enemies who their specific God is, Yahweh, who Yahweh is. But in Psalm 53, what he's doing is different. He's reminding Israel, the people of God, who are suffering. He's reminding them that Yahweh is God and therefore is the judge over their enemies. So he's saying to them, he's not just your God, he's also the God over those people who are surrounding you. He's the God who will judge the nations. And he's done this in other psalms as well. Appeal to the nature of Yahweh who is over them and has made his camp in their midst, and remind them that he's not just their judge, he's judge over the corners of the earth as well. It's really a profound distinction. And so as we come into the 53rd Psalm, we should expect him to be saying to the people of God that you can trust Yahweh because he also has authority over everyone else. Somehow, that's going to be present in the things that were being taught in the 53rd Psalm. So now, into the 53rd Psalm itself, we begin. Verses 1 through 3, they have a singular theme, right? So we'll put them together. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. And he describes the fools, what it means for them to be a fool. They are corrupt, doing abominable iniquity. There is none who does good. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all fallen away. Together, they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. Now, the way we normally use this, and I'm sure we talked about this in the 14th Psalm as well, but the way we normally use these words, the fool says in his heart, there's no God, is to say what a fool an atheist must be, because anyone who says there's no God must be a fool. But this is not that. This is not the direction of the claim that's being made. Grammatically, it could be. I mean, it's not irrational for a person to read that those words in isolation and take them to be a statement about atheism. But that's not the point about them. The point is to say quite the opposite, that anyone who's saying in his heart there's no God is a fool, not because they're saying there is no God, but in fact, by being a person who is corrupt and doing abominable iniquity and not doing good, what they're actually saying on the inside is, there's no God. We're not going to answer to God. We're going to get away with this. And so the fool says, not out loud, not, well, I don't believe in God because science says there's no God, so I'm going to live my life this way. It's not that. The person who's living a corrupt life with abominable iniquity and blah, 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 and we'll talk about what that means, because I know when I say that, everybody starts thinking moralistically and like, oh, well, I've never done those things, and I would never cross that line, and oh, my goodness, I'm more prudent than so-and-so, and I could have lived in the Boston provinces when the religious laws were punishing people for whatever, looking sideways at the neighbor. That's not what he's talking about with this kind of abominable iniquity and the not doing good. And the corruption that's being practiced, it's really a basic corruption that's described in the 14th Psalm as well, by the way, in verse 6, you would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. It's weird that we just do not think that the things God thinks are most important about our morality are all that important. They say, oh, yeah, well, I mean, I give it to the poor. Yeah, it's no big deal. But the main thing is I don't smoke and I don't chew and I don't go with the girls that do. I don't know how we became such Pharisees, but we did. We figured out a way to take the religion that Christ brought to us explicitly to free us from the kind of moralism that blinded us to God's righteousness. That's what Christ brought to us, and we turned his own teachings into a way to get back to that moralistic list and say, well, I'm righteous, so I don't have to worry about those poor people. I'm flabbergasted at our talent of turning the things that God gives us into the opposite of what he actually gave to us. But that's not the point today, although it's present. So here we are in the first verse with simply acknowledging that a person who's not doing God's will is actually saying in their heart, well, there's no God. I'm not going to have to answer to him. I don't have to worry about him. Now, again, the lesson in this psalm, Psalm 53, is not going to be for them. That's Psalm 14. That's the lesson in Psalm 14. You would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is the poor's refuge. So you're making a huge mistake. You should change your mind. This is God speaking to his people now and teaching us something about the way we ought to think. So he says, well, you know, those people, when they live that way, what they're saying in their hearts is there's no God. And you can see this because of their corruption, because of their abominable iniquity, and because they're not doing good. None are doing good, not even one. And what is God looking for in the world? And this is the point of the passage, not to say, oh, those atheists are fools, but instead to say, here's a person who's a fool who ignores God, who acts as if God doesn't exist. And now I just want to change the scenes and look at heaven. So instead of looking down on the earth and saying, is there anybody down there good? No, all these people are wicked. Let's look up at heaven and see what God is doing. So as we look up at heaven, this is what we find. We find that God is looking down from heaven. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to find what? To see if there are any who do what? Is he looking to see if there's anybody who's just following those 10 simple rules that I gave them? Is there anybody who just doesn't envy? Is there anybody who just not lying? He doesn't say that. God is looking down from heaven to see if he can just find one person who's actually looking back up to heaven to see him. That's all he's looking for. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, comma, let's clarify, who seek after God. So God is seeking those who seek him. That's what he's looking for. He's scouring the earth for that. I'll read you the passage in a moment that says those words. God is seeking those who seek him, and he can't find any. So what all that amounts to is saying this: if all God's looking for is somebody who's looking back up and saying, oh, hey there, I see you. I see you in heaven. I know you're up there. He's looking for someone who's seeking him, but he doesn't find any. So God is looking for anyone who's not ignoring him. That's what he's looking for. And what he finds everywhere in the world is people like me and you who are capable of doing our stuff and saying, yeah, I think it'll be okay. I think God's probably not paying attention. I just think he probably doesn't care. So I think we can ignore him right now. And God is just looking for somebody who's not saying that. And while that sounds like it would be condemnatory towards us as the people of God, what's wrong with you people? Why aren't you following? It's actually a word of comfort. God is not searching for anything hard to find. He's just looking for somebody who's looking up to him for help. If somebody will look for help, and you say, well, why are you reading it that way? Because he teaches it so clearly. One of my favorite stories is this story about Asa and Baasha and the fight that they have between Judah and Israel and how Syria gets mixed up in that fight. And all of the reign of Asa is sort of governed by the very meaning of what this psalm is about. And so I'll read to you in two episodes, Asa faces enemies. Asa is this king in Judah, several generations removed from David. And so this is coming after the psalm, but it's living out the lesson of this psalm. And so in the first episode, when Asa's facing these enemies who are coming against him, he does the right thing. And this prophet comes to him and tells him what the consequence of having done the right thing is. And then in the second episode, in the next chapter, the second episode, what happens is Asa denies the right thing. He ignores what he ought to do. And so a prophet comes to him and tells him what's going to be the consequence of that, right? Different prophet. So in 2 Chronicles 15, it puts it this way. The Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. This is when Asa does the right thing. And he went out to meet Asa, and he said to him, hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin, the Lord is with you while you are with him. and hear how he's using this language, and the next words say it explicitly, the exact words, so that we will recognize that all God is looking for is someone who's looking for him. He's scouring the earth trying to find anyone who's trying to find him. And so he says, so the Spirit of God comes on Azariah, the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa, and he said to him, hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin, the Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. For a long time, Israel was without the true God and without a teaching priest and without law. But when in their distress, they turned to the Lord, the God of Israel, and sought him, guess what? He was found by them because this is what he was looking for, just for people to seek him. This is what he desires. So God is seeking those who seek him. The problem is, as he scours the earth to find someone seeking him, he finds none who are. And so by the time you get to the next chapter, you have this next episode where the king of Israel, the northern kingdom, comes down against Judah and fights against Asa. And Asa looks for help, not from God this time, not from Yahweh, but instead goes in and takes implements out of the temple. And I've taught this a long time ago on the radio. I taught this, and you may have heard it then or may not. But it's a great story in the Old Testament, a profound image where Asa should go into the temple to seek the God. This is what the temple is for and the instruments in the temple, to seek God who can bring rescue and refuge. But instead of going into the temple to seek refuge in Yahweh, he goes into the temple and sees all the implements in the temple and says, ooh, there's some gold. I could send that off to Syria and get help from the king of Syria. He looks everywhere but to God for help. And the king of Syria does come and help, but instead of actually being help, he just empowers the king of Syria to become a greater enemy than Israel was to them. And it makes things worse than it was to begin with, even though he thought he had solved the problem. And so what happens in that next chapter after the one that I just read to you from in 2 Chronicles 15, what happens in the following chapter is this statement. And this is another prophet comes to Asa after all these things have happened. And he says to him, oh, you think you've done a good thing, don't you? Because the king of Syria came down and helped you, but you've made a mistake. Because all God wanted you to do was trust him. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro. I'm quoting now the prophet's message. This is the core of that chapter, 2 Chronicles 16. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support, to deliver, to save those whose heart is blameless toward him. And in the previous chapter, at the end of the chapter, he made it clear what it meant for someone's heart to be blameless toward him. He's explicit about it. It means simply that they fully trusted God with the situation. That's why in the previous chapter he says, hey, when the Ethiopians came, when the Libyan came, they were far greater than you and they outnumbered you, but you turned to the Lord and he responded to you. And that's what Azariah is encouraging him for in 2 Chronicles 15. And so in the episode that follows this, this psalm that we're reading, in the episode that follows this in Israel's history, he comes back to them and says, well, the only thing I'm looking for is just for you to turn to me for help. That's all I want. God is seeking someone to seek him for help. And in that same process, what that acknowledges is that if we're not seeking him, like, if we're the people who are creating the problem, let's say we're the enemy who's attacking, it's because we're ignoring God. Well, there's no God. We can do what we want to do to his people. It's not going to make any difference. But also, if we're God's people and we're being assaulted and the world is collapsing around us and we don't turn to him, then we're doing the same thing the enemies are doing. We're acting as if he's not there, and all God is looking for is people who do not ignore him. That's what he wants. So in the first three verses, that's what we hear. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. They're corrupt. They do abominable iniquity. There's none who does good. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. Now we start into verse 4, the second section of the psalm. And this is a statement about all those people who are doing the evil, right? So have those who work evil no knowledge? Who eat up my people as they eat bread? Do they have no knowledge? They're eating my people as if they were just taking a loaf of bread and eating it. Those who do not call upon God, do they have no knowledge? That's verse 4. Have those who work evil no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon God? Do these people know nothing? And so, you know, what he's describing in verse 4 are people who ignore God and therefore, you know, turn to seeking their own solutions. I'm going to find my own solution. And what seeking your own solutions in this life means, because, and this is not an odd coincidence. It's not some big surprise. It's the nature of living in a world with scarce resources. It's the nature of living in a world where if you stand in a place, no one else can stand there. The nature of living in a world like that is that if you turn to seeking your own solutions, then you will begin to consume others for your own sake because you're in competition with them for things, attention, you know, siblings trying to get their parents' attention or coworkers trying to get the same job or promotion or raises or whatever it is. You can say, well, I'm not trying to be against you. I'm just trying to promote myself. But promoting yourself uses some of the resources of others. I know Adam Smith. I appreciate expanding economies. I love all of that, and I talk about all of that freely. But the reality of the world is that we still compete with each other. And as long as we live in a world with scarce resources, we're always going to compete with each other about things. I'm not saying we want to or mean to. It's just an inherent side effect of living in the world. By the way, in parentheses, and spoken softly for those who are not this, if you're an evolutionist, obviously you believe that it's competition that makes people stronger because they have to compete in order to survive. I'm not saying I'm evolutionary. I'm not saying I'm not even an old earth creationist. I'm simply saying the model with which we understand the world, whether we adopt it biologically and scientifically or not, the model with which we understand the world is a competitive model. That's how we interpret everything going in the world right now. So here's the point. That part of it is correct. That when we turn our eyes away from the eternal, from the infinite, because God can supply boundlessly, right? But when we say that, we're saying what's absurd in this world. There's only a certain amount in this world. So if we had turned our attention to God, we would realize this is not the case. But because we have not turned our attention to God, our solutions, the things that we're doing to solve our own problems, end up being things that cause problems for others. So we, in protecting ourselves from being consumed, consume others. Oppressed become oppressors, and so on. It's the story of history, right? So, and God, this is the danger that goes with that, and this is the point of the question in verse 4. We're about to mix verse 5 in here as well, because verses 4 and 5 are the statement to those who are ignoring God. It's about what's going to happen to them. And so in verse 4, all we're doing right now, again, the statement is this: have those who work evil no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon God? So you hear why I'm saying what I'm saying, because those who do not have the knowledge of God's eternal abundance and his desire to help those who turn to him, they eat up other people as if they were eating bread. So you consume others as if they are the product, the sustenance of your own life. They are the thing that provides for you. Instead of calling upon God, those are the two choices. So these people who have no knowledge choose to consume others instead of relying upon God. You hear where I'm coming from now in verse 4. And the problem with that is how God always reveals himself, always. And this is what he does in Jesus. It's what he does when Jesus becomes God in the flesh walking among men. It's what God himself does when he says, I am holy and I want you to be holy. And what does that holiness look like? Read Leviticus 19 and he says this: God always reveals himself as someone looking for someone who's looking for help. And you're making other people need help. Where does that tell you you're going to be in relationship to God? When we're creating our own, we're not thinking to ourselves, oh, I'm going to solve my own problem and make God my enemy. I don't care what he thinks about what I'm doing. We're not saying that. What we're saying is, God, you know, even if there is a God, he's not really paying attention. So I'm just going to ignore God. Then I'll solve my own problem. And by doing that, we inadvertently, at best, inadvertently, start consuming other people and draw God's attention, not even directly to us, but draw God's attention to the people that we're consuming. As God looks at them and says, do you want my help? Because I'd be happy to help, because I love helping people who need help. That's what God wants to do. And we're putting ourselves in the position of being on the opposite side of that when we solve our own problems instead of giving them over to God, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon God. It's interesting, isn't it? Because he wants the people who are being consumed to call upon him. But in this verse, he's not talking about them yet. In this verse, he's talking to the people who are consuming them. You know, you didn't need to consume my people. Call on me. I'll provide for you. He's even saying to the enemies, all I wanted you to do was turn to me for help instead of consuming my people. So have those who work evil no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon God? There they are in verse 5, in great terror where there is no terror. And that description, the phrase that's added artistically and obviously by the psalmist who refines this psalm and puts it in the book again and says, we're going to sing it this way sometime so that we remind ourselves of what God does on our behalf. He reminds us that those who are destroying, those who are consuming, those who have made themselves the enemy of God's people, because not because they picked out God's people and said, I don't like those people, but because they want to consume for their own benefit. He says, he reminds us that those people are the ones who are going to be terrified, and they're going to be terrified even when nothing is chasing them down, the wicked flee. When no man is pursuing that kind of terror, people who are afraid of their own shadow, but who are trying to empower themselves. And by the way, you see this in Saul, right? As he becomes more and more suspicious of everyone around him. And even when people are not fighting against him, even when David refuses to fight against him, he sees David as his greatest enemy. He is in great terror when there is no terror against him. And he brings about, therefore, his own destruction in the process. Anyway, in verse 5, it opens then with that line. There they are in great terror where there is no terror because they didn't seek God for help. They were just consuming the people as if they were bread, trying to solve their own problem. And in the end of verse 5, which is verse 6 in chapter 14, would be equivalent to verse 6 in chapter 14. At the end of verse 5, when it says, for God scatters the bones of him who encamps against you. Now, this is different because he's speaking to the people who are being persecuted. So he's going to scatter the bones of the enemies who are encamped against, and then he doesn't say the people of God. He says you. So he's speaking to his people. And as the, you know, as they would sing this in the congregation, they would be singing it to each other. God scatters the bones of him who encamps against you. And I can say that as if it means something. But can you imagine singing this psalm during the Holocaust? Can you imagine singing this psalm during the days before in Purim, you know, before they had the right to defend themselves, when they were being slaughtered by their enemies? Can you imagine gathering in a home and lifting up your voice to say, we're being destroyed, God, we're being destroyed. What are we supposed to do? And to sing with each other those words, have those who work evil no knowledge, who, and they could see it happening, are eating up my people as they eat bread, and they don't call upon God. Nah, there they will be in terror, in great terror, even where there's nothing hunting them down, because God scatters the bones of him who encamps against you. You. Now, Can you imagine singing this together with people who are facing immediate execution and saying to them, you have this power? Not because you sought the power, because you're not consuming others as if they were your bread to trample over to consume for your own benefit. You're not doing that. But you, because you put your trust in God, you put them to shame because God has rejected them. Because God always reveals himself as the one who is looking for someone who's looking for him. He's just looking for someone who's looking for help. And these are looking for help. And in that moment, they don't say Yahweh. They know who their God is. They know who their covenant is with. It's with Yahweh. So instead, the psalmist has them saying, because the God who is the judge of the entire earth, not just the God who has a covenant with his particular people, but the God who has that covenant with his particular people and whose name you know, he's their God too. And God scatters the bones of those who encamp against you. You who feel so disempowered here, you who feel disenfranchised, you who feel there's nowhere for you to turn, and because you have trusted him that you've somehow been betrayed, no, you will put them to shame because God has rejected them. So what he's really giving you, and that's in contrast to the statement in the 14th Psalm, the statement was to those who were doing the evil. You would shame the plans of the poor, but God is his refuge, but the Lord is his refuge. So he's saying to them, hey, they have a God of covenant who's going to protect them. What he's saying to these is, those who are protected, the God of your covenant isn't just your refuge. He's also their judge. And so you are going to put them to shame. So, you know, what we're really left with is just two choices. We're not at the end of the psalm yet. We've just got a couple of more verses, but we'll get there in a second. One more verse. We'll get there in a moment. But the two choices we have at the close of this section, which is, you know, just about all of this, verses 4 and 5 are simply saying those who ignore God, because remember, God is just looking for people who don't ignore him. So those who do ignore God have something terrible to anticipate. And you can't say anything harsher than what he says in the last half of verse 5 in Psalm 53. God scatters the bones. That statement is profound. I mean, not only in contrast to Ezekiel, you know, the valley of dry bones, the beautiful image of the resurrection, he gathers the bones together, even in our world of burying people in graves or bones just happening to be scattered across the ground in some terrible battle site or something, that statement even makes sense. You know, God takes the bones together and puts the flesh back on them, brings them back to life. But it makes so much more sense in a culture that has these ossuaries, that buries people in bone boxes, meaning you put them in a grave and a year after they have decayed and the flesh is all gone and the bones are dried out, then you go back and you collect the bones and you put them in a box and you store them away. And that's how people are stored for the long term in those caves in the side of the mountain. That's how you store your family members. And whole families are buried in the same cave in these boxes, bone boxes, right? In that story, the whole memory of the person is in this box of bones that's stored in the ground and kept until, as we would anticipate it and as the Pharisees anticipated it, until the resurrection when the bones are brought back to life in that glorious moment, right? So the bones are gathered and collected and boxed and stored and awaiting the resurrection. And what does God do to this enemy? He scatters their bones because they encamped against those who, instead of defending themselves and promoting themselves and consuming others, looked to God for help. And he'll help because that's all he's looking for, is people who are looking to him. And so in verse 6, when we get to the end, it only makes sense now that he's bringing this message to the people of Israel. And as they sing this song, anticipating the day when this misery, when this encamping against them is over with and God has actually revealed all of these things, the psalmist longs for it and the congregation longs for it together, and they're singing of it. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion when God restores the fortunes of his people. Let Jacob rejoice. Let Israel be glad. And I don't think he's saying, in that day, let Jacob rejoice. In that day, let Israel be glad. I think the point of it is saying, I cannot wait for that salvation to come out of Zion. I don't know when it's going to come, but it's going to come when God restores the fortunes of his people. And knowing that that's going to happen, let Jacob rejoice. Let Israel be glad. So we can acknowledge real things to fear in this life. And I'll keep this part short because I realize I have gone the whole time. But we can acknowledge real things to fear in this life. We don't have to be have our head in the sand and just hope for the best in the world. I had just yesterday, as I'm recording this, it was yesterday, a seven-year-old boy. I'm not exaggerating. This is what he said. This, you're going to think I'm making this up, but I'm not making it up. Seven-year-old boy who came to me and said, if God is so good, why does he make tsunamis? This is a seven-year-old boy. That's a legitimate question. Not as important as the questions he will ask, which have to do with the evils he faces. But he's read about tsunamis, or he's seen them on the news, and so it was a question for him to ask. When they come back to his life, then it's going to mean even more when he asks that question. Different day, different story. The point is, we don't have to say, oh, there are no tsunamis. It's okay. Everything's going to be all right. We don't have to say that. We can acknowledge that there are real things to fear in this life. There are people who consume us. There are enemies who encamp against us. There are terrible things that happen. We can acknowledge that and still not live in fear, because we know that the one thing greater than all the things we fear, and therefore the only thing everyone ought rightly to fear, is the God who's over the entire world. And he's its judge. But he lets us know him by name because he has chosen us to be his through faith in his son. That's how we're his. So when genuinely frightening things turn us to seek God, we realize he was already seeking to help us. Poof, no more fear. If only we would seek.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.